From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, a look back at Benjamin Netanyahu's very first election in 1996, one that nearly ended his short career in politics. On April 9th, Benjamin Netanyahu secured his fifth term as Prime Minister of Israel, his fourth consecutively, despite facing a formidable challenger and a string of corruption charges.
He's a magician, this crowd chanted.
He trailed in the opinion polls, but won the only poll that matters, the vote.
He can argue that the Israeli public, knowing what he supposedly did to break the law, despite that, voted to keep him in office.
Netanyahu has led Israel for so long that people there and abroad have come to view him as the face of Israeli politics, as almost inevitable. But Netanyahu's rise was not inevitable at all. When he began his first election campaign in 1996, he trailed the frontrunner Shimon Peres by over 20 points. Months earlier, a right-wing extremist had assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in an effort to end his peace deals with the Palestinians. The murder shocked the country and touched off a backlash against the right in Israel and against Netanyahu himself.
The sign says, "Bibi, Rabin's blood is on your hands."
But a series of missteps on the part of the Labour Party and suicide bombings in early spring 1996 shifted the political calculus. Netanyahu then did what he's done in every election campaign since. He focused on the fears of Israelis, the fear of terrorism and violence, and presented himself as the one man who could protect them. Netanyahu went on to win that vote by less than one percentage point. This week, we revisit the 1996 election in a conversation with Anshel Pfeffer, an Israeli journalist and author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu. So, Anshel, we're speaking just 2 days after Netanyahu has clinched his fifth term as prime minister, fourth consecutive term. But what we wanted to do was actually go back to the first time that he took the prime ministership and look at 1996 and what happened that year after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. He is a fairly young and inexperienced politician at that point, and the assassination traumatizes the country. How is Netanyahu viewed at the moment and the weeks after the assassination?
In the weeks after, he was viewed as an accomplice. The media and most of the politicians of the left wing basically branded Netanyahu as having stoked the incitement which led to the murder. And there were a clear causation was established between Netanyahu and the murderer. Now, that wasn't based on really on facts, but more of a narrative which was built around Netanyahu at the time.
And how does the way that Israelis feel about Oslo change, or does it change, in the weeks and days after the assassination?
Well, there was obviously, after the assassination, a period in which support for Oslo returned and sort of a sympathy for Rabin and for his successor and partner, Shimon Peres, who became prime minister in Rabin's place and the candidate for prime minister in the election.
So Shimon Peres is named the successor, and he doesn't call snap elections right away. Why doesn't he do so?
Well, Peres had a very long and tempestuous relationship with Rabin. They were rivals for all of Rabin's political career. Peres obviously had a much longer political career because he began in politics in the 1950s and Rabin was still in the army. But they were the duo dueling for control of the Labour Party for many years. And the relationship between them was often very toxic. And when finally Peres replaced Rabin, he had already been prime minister once for 2 years, but finally he was going to lead Labour again into an election. He didn't want to do that under Rabin's shadow. Now, most of his advisors told him, go for elections now. We're popular now. We have the nation with us in sympathy after Rabin's murder. Don't wait. Peres wanted to, A, run in his own right. He didn't want to be seen just as a stand-in for Rabin, and that was more his vanity. But also, there was still a lot of negotiations to be done with the Palestinians, and he was hoping also with the Syrians, which he wanted to complete before going to election.
And he thought an agreement with Assad was actually on the horizon.
Well, not only him, a lot of Israeli prime ministers thought that Assad, we're talking obviously about Assad senior, Hafez al-Assad, was someone who they could make an agreement with, also Netanyahu. Assad was always very vague and never actually came to the table.
And at the same time, the issues that we still hear about today, borders, refugees, Jerusalem, none of those things had reached any kind of resolution at that point.
No, and it wasn't even clear what Rabin had intended as a solution. Rabin had said that he wanted the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and in Gaza, partly to keep the peace there. He didn't want the Israeli soldiers to have to continue patrolling Palestinian cities. But Rabin himself was never a supporter of the two-state solution. He had never talked of a Palestinian state as a desired destination. Now, many people believe that had Rabin lived and continued to lead Israel in that process, he would have reached that conclusion, but there's no proof of that ever happening.
But describe those early weeks after the assassination. There's a 30-point polling spread between Netanyahu and Peres. What kind of mood was the country in?
Well, there was a feeling of disbelief, the feeling that a fellow Jew could murder the prime minister of the Jewish state was just something that had never really been taken realistically. Yes, the Shin Bet, the security service, had kept tabs on various extremists, and there was a certain level, higher level of security around Rabin than it had been before, but it still wasn't something that people really thought could happen. And I remember in the years before the assassination, Israeli prime ministers would walk around with bodyguards, but it was nothing like the kind of security you see today around the Israeli prime minister or around leaders like the president of the United States. It was there because they thought, you know, the prime minister needs guards, but there really wasn't a feeling that a Jew, a fellow Israeli, could do something like that. And the shock at the fact that it had happened, and it really was the anger towards Netanyahu from a lot of people on the right was so intense that Likud were thinking at the time that we need to replace the leader. Netanyahu's been tainted. He's toxic. There's no way he'll ever win an election. And there was a serious move within Likud to try and replace him.
And does he lie low then? I mean, does Netanyahu say, I'm going to take a bit of time off, or does he begin to campaign?
Netanyahu, even then, as he has been ever since, has always been in campaign mode. He's one of those politicians who's always thinking about the next election. And from the moment of the assassination, when he understood, and he was surprised first at the ferocity of the anger towards him, but he understood very quickly that he's being blamed, he came to terms with that and thought, how am I going to campaign for prime minister despite being blamed for the murder? And that was, those were his calculations the first day, and he didn't lie low. He gave interviews, he went to the funeral. Famously, Leah Rabin, the widow of Yitzhak Rabin, refused to shake his hand at the funeral, but he did not lie low. He didn't hide himself. He gave interviews, he gave statements, and actually with Shimon Peres's help, he worked very hard in regaining legitimacy as soon as possible.
And Shimon Peres and the security services order an assassination of a Hamas leader. What happened there?
So there was a Hamas leader, an operations chief, who was the main planner and in the first stages also the guy who actually put the bombs together. And he was the mastermind of the suicide bombing campaign. He was lying low then, hiding in Gaza. He was originally from the West Bank, but he had found refuge in a safe house in Gaza. And when the security service managed to locate him, and this was something that was being done without any connection to the political situation, he was top of the target list. Once he was located, as is the case with any similar high-value target of Israeli intelligence, he was brought to a discussion with the prime minister, who was asked, what do we do with him? And Peres didn't want to show any kind of weakness. And he said, well, we have to take him out. This is a man who's responsible for the deaths of dozens, by that period, probably about over 200 Israelis. And we have to work a way to take him out. And when Yichya Ayash, the AKA the engineer, was killed by an explosive device hidden in a mobile phone, which had been smuggled to him by someone who was unwittingly working for Israel as well, that unleashed, as Hamas said, the gates of hell.
And so they carry out this assassination, and Hamas responds by saying that they've opened the gates of hell. What does that mean?
That means that all those who had learned from the now dead Yichya Ayash, the Shahid Yichya Ayash, how to assemble suicide bombs and how to put those missions out, used their acquired knowledge in a campaign of suicide bombing, which happened during the election campaign. So the worst possible political timing. At the end of the day, this was Shimon Peres' decision. Israeli intelligence doesn't carry out a hit without the prime minister's green light.
And do you think that this was a mistake on the part of Shimon Peres then?
I think every Israeli prime minister would have made the same decision. The knowledge that there is someone who has very recently carried out multiple murders of Israeli citizens is not something that any Israeli prime minister can allow not to act upon. It's whether it's a mistake or not is a much wider question. But in that political context at the time, Peres had no choice. And I think that if it had got out that Peres was allowing Yichiel Hayash to remain alive, despite the Shin Bet knowing where he was, that would have been even more damaging politically for him.
But so at this point, there are a series of suicide bombings. It begins with bus number 18, which is actually hit twice, which runs through the artery of Jerusalem. And very quickly, I think 59 Israelis lose their lives in enormous attacks, which also maim a number of people. What does Netanyahu do during all this?
Well, Netanyahu, early in, just before the suicide bombings had begun, had been in New York for 24 hours to meet with his new political strategist. He hired Arthur Finkelstein, who was already well known, though not in the public, but in Republican circles in the U.S., as one of the top campaign directors there is.
So Peres has called an early election at this point, finally, and he's called it for May. And Netanyahu goes to New York and hires Arthur Finkelstein. Tell us a little bit more about him. He'd worked for Republican presidential candidates.
Arthur Finkelstein is the man who famously said that he had made the word liberal a dirty word in American political discourse. Now, Arthur Finkelstein was well known as having run No Hope candidates and won with them. He didn't always win. The man who actually introduced Arthur Finkelstein to Netanyahu, Ronald Lauder, had just lost his attempt to become the Republican candidate as New York governor. But he had been very impressed by his performance, and he introduced Finkelstein to Netanyahu. Finkelstein is well known as the master of short, stark attack ads and of various push-poll phoning tricks. I mean, things that since then have become quite famous in political coverage of campaigns, the things that he was already doing back in the 1980s.
And what are the slogans that he promotes for Netanyahu?
So he did a lot, his people did quite in-depth research of the kind that nowadays is standard for political campaigns in Israel, but at the time was totally innovative, trying to work out the words that would really resonate with Israeli voters. Now, Netanyahu had a problem. He had to somehow remove the taint of being some anti-peace and being somehow accomplice in Rabin's murder. So he had to give an upbeat message. So they worked out the slogan of Netanyahu is going to make a secure peace. And they made a very light and airy television ad in which Netanyahu was a dove flying over him, and it's all very light colors and it's upbeat music. That was the main part of the ads. But these were interspersed with short, very dark clips with black glass breaking, and once the glass breaks, you see Arafat and Peres holding hands at some peace conference, and the slogan, Peres will divide Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem was not being discussed then between Arafat and Peres. It was one of the final status issues which had yet to even reach the negotiations. But Finkelstein had discovered that Jerusalem was one of the words that really resonate with the Israeli public, including centrist voters, not necessarily those who were aligned with the settlers or with the far right. And he said, we have to push on Jerusalem. And it didn't matter how many times Shimon Peres said, this is all lies. I have never spoken with Arafat and don't intend to speak with Arafat about Jerusalem. That stuck.
So here we are. Netanyahu has hired Finkelstein. This terrible wave of suicide attacks has taken place. The campaign is in full swing, but Peres has made a series of missteps since the assassination in terms of running his own campaign.
Well, part of the problem was that Peres began the campaign leading Netanyahu by 20 points. And at the time in Israel, the thought of Bibi Netanyahu, the man who was seen by so many as an accomplice in the murder, a man who was now being portrayed as this violent, insightful figure, insightful with CIT, not as a man of insight at the time. He was seen as the biggest mistake Likud had ever made in electing him as leader. The thought that he could beat Shimon Peres, the dead rabbin's successor, was simply unimaginable. And just in the numbers, he was losing by 20 points at the time. And it was that was 4 months before the election. And Peres was taking his victory for granted. He couldn't imagine a scenario where he wasn't going to win the election.
Netanyahu begins bargaining with various ministers, and he reaches out to the Haredi, the Orthodox parties. What does he do?
Well, At the time, the ultra-Orthodox parties, the Haredi parties, were not, as they are today, so firmly aligned with the right wing. They were seen as the kingmakers of Israeli politics, and they would sit with left and right wing governments if their demands were met. So both Peres and Netanyahu began courting the rabbis who direct their followers how to vote. In it was almost a beauty contest whereby Peres and Netanyahu would show up at some gathering of rabbis and try and show which one of them is more attuned to religion, who knows more about the laws of the Torah and the mitzvot, and who will have a more Jewish traditional policy. Now, this is something that the politicians never had to do because they would always deal with the political leaders of those parties in closed rooms, in negotiations over who would sit in whose coalition. Suddenly, they had to appeal to the Haredi voters themselves. And the thought was that Netanyahu, who had only 2.5 years earlier been involved in a sex scandal in which he had admitted to cheating on his wife, he would be at a disadvantage. Whereas Shimon Peres, who had known many of the senior rabbis for many years as a veteran politician, he was already someone that the rabbis knew and liked, and he would get the support of all the chief rabbis. In the end, it turned out the opposite.
And why was that? What was Netanyahu able to offer the Orthodox that Peres was not?
First of all, Netanyahu realized that the Orthodox, perhaps less the senior rabbis, but certainly the rank and file, the many followers of these rabbis, felt much closer to the right wing, not necessarily because they were more nationalist, but because they had felt that the old elite, the old left-wing establishment, which has founded the state and had been in power for the first 3 decades of Israel, had always shut out the religious, and especially the ultra-Orthodox, and they felt an affinity with Likud, because Likud was the party of the outsiders. Now, Likud had been in power from 1977 on and off by the time, so almost 20 years by the time Netanyahu came along as leader of Likud, but that feeling of outsiderness was still very much alive, both within Likud and amongst the ultra-Orthodox community. So that was something Netanyahu understood instinctively that he can latch on. And perhaps the senior rabbis didn't realize at the beginning how popular Netanyahu would be amongst their followers. But they also have to contend with their constituency, perhaps not in the same way that the Democratic leader has. But it very quickly became evident that Netanyahu, as a leader of Likud, as someone who knows how to appeal to these feelings of resentment and of outsidersness, would be someone who the rabbis' followers would vote for. And the rabbis were sort of forced by their own followers to go along with Netanyahu.
And as you mentioned, with Finkelstein in his court, Netanyahu begins to use fear effectively, fear of Hamas, fear of the division of Jerusalem, and fear even becomes one of the campaign's slogans. How is fear effective?
Well, fear is obviously one of the greatest motivators of any human being, and we've seen across the world politicians fear-mongering their way to office. Netanyahu has done so extremely effectively, but the stage was made for Netanyahu. We're talking a period about not just buses blowing up, but about Israelis not knowing if when their kids are going to school, if they're going to get there in one piece because of that, especially in the big cities where this was happening. You know, the Israelis are used to soldiers being killed in wars or in various actions on the border. They were used to terror attacks before that, but the fact that this was happening almost daily on the streets of the two biggest cities in Israel, in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, really created an atmosphere which was just ripe for Netanyahu to exploit.
President Bill Clinton showed a clear preference for Shimon Peres and put his thumb, or tried to put his thumb, it appears, on the scale of that election to some degree. But does that backfire?
Well, I don't know if it backfired, but it certainly didn't help Peres. Clinton hosted him in the White House with the most lavish reception, at least until Donald Trump received Netanyahu in this election campaign. He traveled to the region to attend a multi-leader summit in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt together with Peres. And then he came to Israel, and he did everything possible that a president can do until Donald Trump came along to help an Israeli prime minister in an election. And at the time, it was very clear his preference. He made no attempt to hide it. He did, as protocol dictates, meet Netanyahu for a very short meeting during that visit to Israel. It was clear that he's just ticking a box by meeting the leader of the opposition. So Clinton did everything possible, but there was a limit to what he could do. He couldn't change Israelis' minds. The Israelis already knew that the administration was on Peres' side. And that also, in a way, perhaps not the meetings with Clinton, but the fact that Peres spent so much time on the campaign meeting with foreign leaders and flying to other countries also helped the impression that he wasn't totally connected to the concerns of Israelis who were fearing with their lives. It's suddenly something that the Likud made a big deal out of.
So May 26th is a debate between Netanyahu and Peres. Tell me a bit about the debate.
Well, Peres hated the idea of having to do a debate, and he was hoping that he could just get out of the Israeli custom, copied from the American type of television debate, was quite a young one. It only happened first in 1977, and Peres has Israeli television. There was only 1.5 television channels at the time. The whole idea of conducting a campaign on television was pretty new. And the only person who really knew how to do it was Netanyahu, who had spent his 20s and early 30s in the States and had himself, as Israel's main representative in New York, had been a frequent star in the studios there. He had learned how to do it. Peres didn't really know how to look at the camera. He was used to speaking at party of rallies. He wasn't used to speaking in front of a camera. The whole idea that he would be in a studio and he would have to joust with someone, that someone would challenge him, and it wouldn't just be a journalist asking polite questions, was anathema to him. Whereas Netanyahu, he's in his element when he has to debate someone on television.
And so the outcome of the debate is a win for Netanyahu.
It was a clear win for Netanyahu. Peres wouldn't even look at Netanyahu. And at the end of the debate, when each of the candidates was offered a chance to address a question to each other, Peres wouldn't even use that opportunity. He just made a statement. He didn't even ask Netanyahu anything. While Netanyahu was clearly in control of that debate. Even Peres's people admitted afterwards that we lost that. They still believed, because they were 5 points still in the lead, and that wouldn't make that much of a difference.
And so now we're at the night of the election, but still Peres goes in assuming that he's going to win.
Well, on the day before the election, the last polls gave Peres a 2-point lead. They said he's going to win. Netanyahu's done a good job of almost closing the gap, but he's going to win. Even as the polls closed and the exit polls came out, it still showed 50.5%. So that was even smaller than 2% lead, but still Peres winning. And as the headlines would say, that on the 2 days afterwards, Israel went to sleep with Peres and woke up with Netanyahu.
So in just 6 months, Israel's gone from grieving the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and showing an overwhelming support for his Labor Party to electing Benjamin Netanyahu and putting Likud into the prime minister's office. What does that election foreshadow about Netanyahu in your mind and about his now quite long career in Israeli politics?
Well, there are a number of elements that appeared in that election which have appeared ever since. First of all, the result. Netanyahu has never won a landslide. People talk of Netanyahu as being a winner, as having this knack of winning elections. That's not entirely true. He's lost 2 elections, and every single election he's won has been by small margins. Netanyahu is someone who counterintuitively doesn't run an election from the center. He runs an election by going rightwards towards his base and by gathering as many of these resentful and disgruntled parts of Israeli society, even those parts which have actually been in power for a long time, and make them feel that they need to hold onto power with their fingernails because the establishment is coming back to take it. And we've seen that in every single election Netanyahu has run. The other thing we saw in 1996 is that on the last 3 days, suddenly out of nowhere, a group of ultra-Orthodox Jews, in that case it was the Chabad Hasidim, ran their own independent campaign, ostensibly with nothing to do with the Likud campaign, with the slogan Netanyahu is good for the Jews. Now, officially, it wasn't part of the Netanyahu campaign. Likud had nothing to do with it, but Netanyahu was obviously in contact with the rabbis of Chabad, and they were working totally with his blessing. And that was I wouldn't say blatantly racist campaign, but it was certainly a dog whistle saying he's good for the Jews. In other words, he's the one the Arabs don't want to win. And Israel has 20% of an Arab population. It was already then delegitimizing their vote. And we've seen that with Netanyahu ever since. He's always tried, sometimes obliquely and sometimes quite blatantly, certainly in the last 2 elections, 2015 and 2019, he's used the Arab card in a very clear way.
What happens after that? Is there a sense in 1996 of shock the next day?
The shock, certainly among the left wing, was intense. Of people talking about, this is it, we're leaving the country. All of Rabin's admirers and supporters felt that they had been let down by the Israeli public. It really was something that no one had expected, even though the gap was closing, even though it was clear that Netanyahu was running such a more effective campaign than Peres' campaign. It was still something that that was almost a second shock after Rabin's murder. People said we felt that Rabin had been murdered again. And we have to remember that the Israeli media overwhelmingly was on Peres's side. It was Netanyahu against all the odds. He had started at a 20-point deficit with the media against him, with all the country's main cultural figures and opinion makers saying that he's going to lose, he's got no chance, and we shouldn't vote for him, and he's dangerous, and he ended up winning. And that was just something that they couldn't... I think that a large part of the left wing has never forgiven Netanyahu for winning that election.
And looking back on it now, given the tight race that happened just over the last few days, did this feel like a reprisal in some way, or have you come to expect something like this?
We've come to expect something like this, but it's like Netanyahu is still running that race even today. The resentment, his own personal resentment against the media for being against him, and the resentment of his supporters. They're feeling that they're always battling the odds. They're always battling stronger forces. They're battling a deep state. They're battling these devious left-wingers who will stop at nothing to stop the nation from expressing its will, has remained the themes of Netanyahu's politics ever since.
Angelo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I hope it was useful.
That was Angelo Pfeffer, author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs, with production assistance by Benjamin Soloway. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host.